Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle, and in this episode, we are talking about sex, about consent, about assault, and about a book that looks at the narratives around all of these subjects, topics that we don't talk about very much, the grey areas that often lurk in the shadows.
You know, when people are talking on TikTok about like, oh yeah, like choke someone or like this person choked me, it's like, well, if it's not consensual, then it's sexual assault. And actually, the law in England and Wales is really clear on that. There is a threshold of violence that you can consent to, and choking, strangulation is beyond that.
That was the voice of my guest today, Rachel Thompson there. And I should mention that this episode discusses sexual assault and sexual violence and content that some listeners may find triggering or even distressing. But it does explore really important themes that rarely get discussed elsewhere. So we do hope you can stay with us. Thompson's book, Rough, which is a new non-fiction work exploring the narratives of sexual violence that, as I mentioned earlier, we don't often talk about. And maybe you had a bad sexual experience in your past and never addressed it for actually what it was, pushing it to the back of your mind or even blaming yourself. We're talking about those grey areas, violations. As women and girls, we sometimes have sexual experiences that we don't have words for, that don't seem to fit with how we understand and perceive sexual assault. And the author of Rough says the way we talk about topics such as sex, consent and assault aren't fit for purpose anymore. The book contains really powerful testimony from 50 women and non-binary people. It's a book that shines a light on the sexual violence that takes place in our bedrooms and beyond, sometimes at the hands of people we know, trust, or even love. So I talked to the author, Rachel Thompson, about violations such as stealthing, non-consensual choking, and non-consensual rough sex acts that our culture is only starting to recognise as sexual violence. Rachel Thompson is a writer, journalist, podcaster, and, as I said, the author of Rough, How Violence Has Found Its Way Into the Bedroom and What We Can Do About It. As a journalist, Rachel specialises in reporting on sex, relationships and gender. She's the senior culture reporter at Mashable and has written for the Sunday Times, CNN, Elle and many others. We talk about some of the challenging subjects in her book, challenging but very important ones. And I began by asking Rachel why she wanted to explore these often hidden and difficult to talk about issues.
I started researching around the time of the Me Too movement. I felt like there was a kind of a conversation that was sort of happening, but not quite happening, in that people were talking about something called grey areas. And I wanted to know, okay, what do we mean by grey areas? Because there was a lot of like conversation online about like, oh, there's no such thing as a grey area. And I found that, I was like, I understand, you know, the point that you're making here, but also I think it is going to require a bit more nuance. And so I started to think about my own grey area, what I would deem grey area experiences. And I sort of like, I took a few days to just sort of like think back to, I think I just turned 30 when I was researching this. And I started to think back to sort of like 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. And just when I was at university, or when I was a teenager, and some of those like early experiences that I had. And I thought back to one particular experience that I had always just called sort of bad sex, right? And it was just something that, oh, you know, it was just a bad sexual experience. At the time, I don't think I would have called it that, because the narrative, I think, amongst all of my friends was, oh, you know, like everyone's just having loads of casual sex and like, you know, that's what all the young people are doing. I think I sound old when I say that. But, you know, it's like, I felt a kind of almost peer pressure to be like doing the cool thing, which was having all of this, young, carefree, casual sex with no strings and, you know, racking up as many sexual partners. And that was a sign of, I guess, being a cool person. And that was a misconception on my part because, I mean, lots of research has come out. There was a report last week even that says that this is a major source of anxiety for a lot of British people of all age groups, actually. You know, that basically people think everyone else is having way more sex than they are. And in reality, they're not. Like, people are just having, you know, just a standard, and some people aren't having sex at all, and a lot of young people are having way less sex. So statistically we know that actually this isn't true, and this was all sort of like anxiety and trying to just, I don't know, be a cool young person at university. I was like very, very inexperienced. I was a very innocent, you know, when I left home to go to university, I think I'd maybe had sex once, and that was just like a one night stand. And so I was very, very inexperienced, and I hadn't had very good sex education. You know, I'd gone to a state school. I think my sex education sort of amounted to some very embarrassed looking teacher putting a condom over a banana and then just showing us some pictures of some really gnarly looking STIs, and us thinking like, great, well, that looks horrifying. So yeah, I was really ill-equipped. You know, I didn't really know anything at all about consent. I just thought this is, you know, something that is just a chat at the start, or not even a chat. You're just like, do you consent? Yes. Then everything after that is, you know, do whatever you want. And I think that particular thing, that particular misconception, misunderstanding, did me a real disservice in terms of those early sexual experiences, really up until I would say my mid-20s, because I didn't know that, you know, each individual sex act required consent. And it's not just that yes at the start and then everything goes, you know, it's, you know, if you want to do something different, if you want to switch positions, it's everything requires like, is this okay? And it doesn't have to be like a very formal, do you consent? It's a, you know, is this okay? Like, can we do this? You know, it's, there are sexier ways of doing it. And we know from like, you know, Connell in Normal People that it can be kind of hot actually to ask for consent. Anyway, I digress. So, you know, this experience that I talked about in the first chapter of Rough, it took me a really, really long time, essentially, to realise that what had happened that night was actually sexual assault. And, you know, I had basically, I'd had a one night stand with this guy and I really liked him. But he wasn't, I don't think he particularly treated me very nicely. You know, he'd sort of gone, he was blowing hot and cold, sometimes replying to my messages, sometimes sending me a sort of you up message, like at 2 a.m, which I'd inevitably see, you know, the next day. But I have epilepsy, and I had had that first night that we'd had together, I had had a seizure. And so I felt this vulnerability that he had witnessed that. He'd, you know, called the ambulance and walked me to my door because I literally couldn't remember where I lived after having this seizure. And so, you know, the bar is in hell, I guess. You know, this is really, we're talking about the bare minimum of like human compassion. And, you know, of course, like, it was nice to be looked after in that moment, but, you know, what's the alternative? Just letting someone have a seizure and then just fend for themselves? But I just interpreted that, perhaps because I had, again, very little experience, but also had been shown very little kindness by any men outside of my own family, you know. So I was like, wow, this guy's great, like, what an absolute hero. Which of course was not really true at all. And yeah, so I just had this idea of him being a way nicer person than he actually was. And of course I wanted to see him again after that. And so when we did see each other, this was when we were in university and I had a roommate. So I was sharing my room with a girl. He was sharing his room with a boy. And, you know, so we decided to go off into the woods. And I just thought we were just going to have, you know, sex. But it just sort of took a weird turn and he ended up sort of straddling my chest, which I found I couldn't breathe, essentially. And I did not, I felt like I didn't sign up for this. And also, I can't breathe and I feel like I might die. And in that moment, I was just like, oh my God, I can't breathe. What am I going to do? And I didn't think to sort of like, I just sort of froze in that moment. And I didn't think to be like, hey, like, or slap him or something just to alert him in a like non-verbal way, because I couldn't speak, basically. I just sort of was polite and sort of, you know, it's amazing the things that women do when they just want to be polite and, you know, be the cool girl and be, you know, chill. And I don't understand where that came from. But I mean, like subsequently, therapists have told me it's really that freeze reaction is really normal. So, you know, but yeah, in that moment I froze. But, you know, in the aftermath of that, I sort of, you know, I felt quite degraded and violated, but I would not have admitted that to anybody, even myself, I suppose. I sort of just was like, well, you know, that wasn't exactly what I signed up for. And that wasn't really what I had in mind, but you know, and I still liked the guy. That's the sad thing. I still liked him. I still wanted to hang out with him after I saw, like, after that had happened. And that's quite sad, I think. I just think, oh, God, like, you know, poor, like, 19-year-old Rachel just didn't have a clue and hadn't been well-equipped with, you know, not only, like, the basics of consent, the basics of, like, everything you should know before you have sex, but also, like, self-worth and like how I deserve to be treated and like the kind of people I should be letting into my life and like the kind of behavior that I should be tolerating. So there was a lot that, you know, a lot that fed into that.
You mentioned Me Too there. So it's like 6 years ago now or something like that. And it feels like, as far as I remember, that was a time when many of us were looking at those gray areas. We're looking back over sexual experiences we'd had that maybe we'd buried or that we'd put down to just being a woman and being in the world. And that's what you put up with. And really, a lot of us, I think, had to kind of face up to things that were, you know, from maybe, I suppose what you describe in the book as unacknowledged sexual assault or times when we just felt, oh, that was a weird night, or didn't really enjoy that sexual experience, but it was grand and I'll just move on. And these things seem to really bubble to the surface. And I think that's at the crux of your reason for writing the book, is so that people can open up and face up to these things and be more aware of what it is they do want in sex. So talk to me about more about those grey areas and this idea that one of the experts you talk to says that women are sort of socialized almost to be the sexual pleasure givers, providers, something that, you know, women are something that sex is done to rather than them being an active sort of a part in the pleasure seeking aspect of it. That's a really important part of the book, I think.
Definitely. And yeah, so you talk about sort of the unacknowledged rape, unacknowledged sexual assault aspect. And that was a key, I think that's the essentially one of two things going on in the grey areas. I sort of, when I began to sort of dig into it and speak to academics, speak to, you know, researchers in this area, they, you know, I discovered, I hadn't heard this term before, unacknowledged rape. And I thought, hang on a sec, like that actually is what happened to me. You know, it took me 10 years to realize, to have the language to define what had happened to me as something other than just a bad sexual experience, and realize actually this meets all of the legal, you know, requirements as well as the, you know, societal requirements of sexual assault. And actually what I heard from these experts is that it's really common, actually. It's really, really common for women to essentially not immediately call what has happened to them, to not immediately be like, that was sexual assault or that was rape. And of course that does happen, you know, a lot of people do also realize, you know, yes, okay, what's just happened to me is rape, is sexual violence, but an awful lot of people also have that delayed reaction, and sometimes that comes from, you know, a lack of education, a lack of knowing that certain things constitute sexual violence. I think that also the, you know, the lack of I think that the law lagging behind in certain areas and not recognizing certain things as sexual assault also plays a role, because that, you know, is sort of that seeps into society. If the law doesn't recognize something as sexual assault, then people in society are like, well, it doesn't really count. And it's like, well, actually, is the law just the barometer of morality? No.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, you know, I think it's also just sort of, it is a kind of trauma response to have that sort of like, okay, I'm just going to put this to the back of my mind, you know, and never think about it ever again. And yeah, it takes people a long time sometimes to recognize that what's happened to them, yeah, is sexual violence.
And then it informs how their sexual life continues as well, because it's one case study in your book of a woman who, I think it was her first sexual experience with the person who then went on to become her boyfriend for 3 or 4 years. She was actually asleep, I think, when he had sex with her. And she didn't even at the time equate it with an assault or a rape. You know, how could she possibly consent when she wasn't even conscious? And yet she went on to continue to have a relationship with that person. And there's case studies in the book that sort of really illuminate what you're talking about. You also look a lot at sexual behaviours that have become more normalised and more common. And I did an article in the Irish Times last year, which was talking to a lot of young women and men and people of all types about their sexual activity, particularly during the pandemic, where it seemed that this stuff became very much prevalent on TikTok about vanilla sex. So vanilla sex being very ordinary, missionary position, you're not kinky at all. And then if you were just doing that, there was something wrong with you, that there should be some kind of choking involved, and this various aspects of BDSM that were coming into it. And these young people were telling me that this was sort of very regularly happening in their sex lives. And sometimes they didn't like it, but they would continue with it. Or sometimes they seem to be saying they liked it, but I really wonder, did they really like it, or was it about, again, pleasing the person that they were with? I just wanted to read out actually a couple of case studies, if that's okay, because I think some people listening might not be familiar with this stuff, because again, it's very influenced by porn. I think porn culture, you say that in the book as well. And so there's a woman called Abigail. She says, I went back to his afterwards with the intention of having sex, and during sex he choked me without my consent, was extremely rough and hit parts of my body. She says she was more shocked than frightened when it happened. When he was choking me, I didn't have the breath to tell him to stop, and he seemed to be enjoying it, so I didn't want to make a fuss. And that's so let's talk first about the choking thing, because that's very prevalent and not something that everyone wants. And as you say in the book, a very high risk sexual activity.
Yeah, definitely. And I think talking about, first of all, because you mentioned TikTok just then, and I think it's really important to note that, you know, we are living in actually a sex misinformation crisis, and TikTok is playing a really big role in that, and not for the better, I might add. There's a lot of kink educators who are really concerned about misinformation specifically relating to kink, to BDSM, and, you know, people who are not experts, people who are not sex educators, who are not members of this community, who are essentially spreading misinformation on TikTok and also on other social media sites, you know, Instagram as well. And, you know, that is reaching young people who perhaps, you know, haven't had good sex education. I think that's probably the case for a lot of young people, but also maybe don't have essentially what we would call like porn literacy or like sex literacy, health literacy. So those kind of important critical thinking skills that you would need in order to like discern who's actually an expert that you should be listening to and who's actually spreading misinformation. And I think this sort of topic of vanilla sex being somehow less than
uncool.
Yeah. I think that this, you can trace it back to a lot of these, you know, this TikTok misinformation, because vanilla sex, first of all, like anyone in the BDSM community would probably tell you that there should never be any kind of hierarchy when it comes to, you know, whether one type of sex is better than the other. Like, It's all good, I think, that most people would, I don't, you know, I'm sure maybe some people would disagree, but essentially, you know, what we should be, in terms of true sex positivity and in terms of being, you know, reaching a sort of like point where we're able to speak freely and from an informed place, I think that moving away from this idea of there being a hierarchy of vanilla being somehow, you know, not as good as kinky sex. That is not true sex positivity and, you know, is misinformed. And also the idea of like normativity of one thing being normal and one thing being not. Again, I think a lot of people in that space would sort of say that that's not, it's not a good way to look at sex. But yeah, I think a major problem coming out of TikTok and also coming out of just a lot of online discussion about sex that is forming part of this sex misinformation crisis. I think the idea of choking being a really common thing in sex that also doesn't require consent. And I find that really concerning. And I know that also porn culture, as you mentioned, like porn culture does feed into this because, again, I think a lot of people treat, we know statistically, there's loads of research that because young people don't have, you know, robust sex education, many don't have any at all, actually, they turn to porn as an educational tool. When in fact porn is designed as entertainment, it's, you know, fantasy, it's, you know, it's not being made with education in mind. They're not thinking like, oh, we really, you know, the responsible thing to do here would be to show consent, negotiation would be to show all of the safety protocols. That's just not a thing that porn, you know, like the people in the porn industry are thinking about because it's entertainment, you know. And so yeah, it's not real life. And I think there, and I think that's the danger of, you know, and that's the knock-on effect of not teaching young people about sex, you know, all of the sort of basic tenets of sex that we should be, that we should know before we even think about having sex. That's the knock-on effect, because then you have all of these very curious young people thinking, okay, hang on a sec, like, how do I give a blowjob? How do I do a hand job? All of these things, you know, and they're turning to porn as their sort of teacher. And then they see things in porn that, you know, like a really common trope is choking in porn. That's become a really prevalent thing in mainstream porn. But because, of course, it's entertainment, it's not shown with all of the consent and safety protocols that would always happen when it's practiced, when breath play, as it's called in the BDSM community, when that is you know, carried out in real life by these communities that are coming from a place of, you know, that informed risk. And so that's how I feel this has infiltrated the sort of sex culture that we're talking about. And so, yeah, it's really dangerous because choking is a high risk act. And we know that there's research that they've done, academics have done research into the dangers of this. You know, it can cause strokes, it can cause neurological damage, seizures. I mean, we know also it can and has resulted in death. You know, it's not something to be entered into lightly. And I think, you know, breath play, when it's practiced in the BDSM community, it is practiced with, first of all, consent, and also with all of these safety protocols, you know, like people researching the anatomy of a neck to ensure that they're not, you know, cutting off blood flow, cutting off, you know, an entire air supply, all of these things. But it's something that requires like complex research, and like you need to be informed. You need to know what you're doing.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
What I found fascinating as well, talking to these young people, was that it's very much in these sexual behaviors, the men dominating the women. Like when I would ask them, oh, do you choke your partner? And they would go, no, of course not. You know, it's never the women choking the men. It's this constant thing of, you know, the man dominating. And there was a sense of, one young woman said to me, well, you know, I feel like my partner, like in the world we live in now, women are more equal. We're all the same, you know, but it's nice in the bedroom for the man to be able to dominate. This was actually what one woman said to me. The other thing I found really interesting talking to them was about their lack of necessarily feeling like they needed to orgasm during sex. Like a lot of the time, these young people were very much like, well, as long as he gets off, as long as he has his orgasm, then that's the sexual activity finished. But just going back to the choking aspect, you have a statistic in the book, which is from the UK, but I imagine there must be a similar trend in Ireland as well. I think it's over one third of women have experienced non-consensual strangulation or choking in their sex lives, which is, you know, a lot of people.
It's a lot. It's alarming, really, because, you know, and that, it's that element of the, you know, non-consensual that is sexual assault. And, you know, we're not talking about, you know, when people are talking on TikTok about like, oh yeah, like, you know, this, like, choke someone or like this person choked me. It's like, well, if it's not consensual, then it's sexual assault. And actually the law in England and Wales is really clear on that. There is a threshold of violence that you can consent to, and choking, strangulation is beyond that. And I think that one of the really important things that when I was writing this book, you know, I wanted to explore some of the violations that people weren't referring to as violations. They weren't referring to as sexual violence. And I think that this is one of them. I think that in our conversations, you know, we often, you know, we talk about just choking as a sort of catch all. And I think a lot of the time, actually, what we're talking about and what we're talking about in this instance, we're talking about sexual assault. And I don't think many people, I don't think many young people who've maybe gone through this, maybe, you know, young women, I don't think they realize that actually what's happened to them constitutes sexual violence. And there's that lack of education, really. So part of the work I try and do, obviously part of the purpose of the book, but also in my work at Mashable, I you know, try and debunk a lot of these sex myths, a lot of these, you know, the myths that we have, you know, that I think really young people need to know.
Let's talk for a minute about, some of our listeners will know about, which came up in the amazing series I May Destroy You, which is stealthing. I'm just going to give a little case study that you have in the book. Daisy says she was having a lovely time. She was on top and she felt in control until, that is, she became aware that the condom had come off. The man she was having sex with kept going, however, as if nothing had happened. Daisy says that she wasn't very experienced. She didn't feel she could assert herself in the situation. I remember thinking, well, I'm on top, so I must be in control of this. This must be fine as well, because it's not like he was pinning me down or anything, but I just did not feel able to say, hang on, I think the condom has come off. Then he finished and he was hanging onto my hips, he said, and I just said, did you just come inside me without a condom? And he smiled at her in a way she describes as, ah, shucks expression, before saying, oh, whoops, sorry. It was his next act that fully revealed the non-accidental nature of the violation. He did this really hokey thing, Daisy says. He kind of looked to one side where he'd clearly taken it off and tossed it. And he was like, oh, there it is. So this thing of stealthing, where people are either pretending not to have condoms or making sure they get rid of them during the sex act. Because that was another thing that these young women said to me, was that a lot of the time they're hearing men just saying, oh, it doesn't feel as good, I don't want to do this. It's a very interesting phenomenon. And the stealthy way that they're doing it is so dangerous and worrying.
Again, yeah, this, and so, yeah, this non-consensual condom removal stealthing, as we sort of saw in I May Destroy You, it's sexual violence, it's sexual assault and rape, you know. And I think that it was just so disturbing to, I mean, that story that you just read out, it's so alarming as well, just to feel, these young women don't feel that they can also say anything, that again, it sort of circles back to this prioritization of male pleasure in that moment. But yeah, that this is something that I know that a lot of viewers who watched I May Destroy You actually realized that, you know, they had experienced this, and it was really validating to see that on screen, because they were like, oh, this has happened to me, and this was something that was a source of complete trauma and violation and anxiety, you know, because obviously with a lack of protection, a lack of barrier protection, there's all kinds of anxiety, even, you know, even if it's completely accidental, you know, and this happens in real life, you know, we know that you have pregnancy scares, you worry about STIs, you worry about all of these things. And, you know, there was an interview, I think it was in British Vogue, where a journalist spoke to women who watched I May Destroy You and saw, yeah, this unfold on screen of like, oh, this happened to me. Oh, there's a word for this. Oh, my God, it's sexual assault. And again, it circles back to that unacknowledged rape, unacknowledged sexual assault, of us not having the language and the knowledge to know that an experience of violation counts as violence. And and so you have this delayed onset. And I think that I found it really striking that, you know, these women, some of them were watching with like husbands, boyfriends, partners, and were telling them for the first time, like, hey, this happened to me, and talking about all of the impact it had on them. You know, there was one woman who said that she was terrified that she had HIV after it happened, and, you know, and to feel, and some of them said that they felt dirty, and, you know, they felt like a slut and things like that. And, you know, that's the impact of this. And again, I think when I started talking about stealthing around the time that my book was coming out, a lot of people hadn't heard this term. And it's, you know, I think I May Destroy You's done a brilliant thing in that it has raised awareness. But for people who haven't seen that particular show, there is still that knowledge gap. And I think it's important that, you know, like that we talk about contraception in our consent education, that young people know that, you know, actually legally it's called conditional consent. And the condition that you consent to is, you know, using a condom or using whatever barrier protection, but that is the condition of consent. And if that condition is not respected, not honored, then it's non-consensual, and therefore it's rape or sexual assault.
Yeah, I mean, and another thing I'd love you to talk about a bit, which I find, I mean, grimly fascinating, is that, like, if I was walking down the street and a man exposed his penis to me on the street, I could ring the police and it'd be a very clear case of a sexual violation, right? And there would be, you know, a legal recourse for that. But what's known as cyber flashing, where people are more commonly called unsolicited dick pics. I just hate that term. But anyway, cyber flashing. This is happening so commonly I have to put my hands up, being of a certain age, in my 50s. It's never happened to me. I hope it never happens to me. But I know that for a lot of young women, it is a very common experience, and not something that I wonder if people even become sort of inured to it, immune to it. But talk to us about cyber flashing and the sort of attempts to make that be legally kind of, you know, wrong.
Yeah. So there's currently a campaign that the dating app Bumble, they are sort of championing, and there's a lot of other journalists in the UK, like Sophie Gallagher, who have sort of done a lot of reporting and campaigning to get the attention of lawmakers, to encourage them to make cyber flashing illegal, because it's something that happens particularly on public transport, using the AirDrop feature on a lot of iPhones. And when I started reading about this, I thought, oh my God, I need to change my settings immediately, because I didn't realize that my AirDrop settings were set to anyone can send me anything. And, but, you know, that's, I think, I mean, who's looked into that? You know, I think it's common for a lot of us to not realize. But yeah, what was happening, and I spoke to a few people when I was researching the book, that, you know, women late at night would, they'd enter an empty tube carriage, or there'd be like a couple of other people in there, and they'd be deliberately targeted by a person that had obviously clocked them and then sent them an explicit photo, usually of their genitals. And the thing about AirDrop is that it often flashes up a preview of the image on your screen before you even accept the image. And so it was really disturbing, really threatening, because, you know, if it had been in real life, like if it had been a non-digital act, then, you know, it would, that people would take it seriously. But because it's a digital violation, there is that, the government in the UK certainly is not keeping pace with the way that digital sex crimes are being created. You know, they're being, the fast-paced way in which it's evolving, and I think that that's alarming, and that's they're still campaigning to get cyber flashing included in the digital harms bill. I think there may be an update on it. I think it will be included in that,
because there was a change in the law around upskirting, which is another activity that, again, probably the law wasn't keeping pace with, but now it's illegal in Britain, isn't that right?
Exactly, yeah. Gina Martin, an activist, she campaigned and successfully got the law changed in England and Wales. And so there's been a massive, uptick in convictions for that. And that's, you know, again, for people that aren't familiar with the term upskirting, it's when a person takes a photo up a person's skirt, or basically of their genitals, without their consent. And, you know, it happens on public transport, happens in public places. In the case of Gina Martin, it happened at a music festival. And, you know, it's also, there's a term called down blousing as well, which is, you know, as the term might, you know.
No, that's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah. So that's the, you know, the equivalent for when it's, you know, when it's basically someone taking a picture of your breasts. Yeah. So, so it took a while again for the law to keep up with that. I think that it shows how out of touch lawmakers are, that, you know, we're having to come to them often being like, hey, like, there's loads and loads of victims that are like dealing with this and you need to do something about it. So, I mean, it's good news, at least, that it's on the, you know, that cyber flashing is on their horizons and, you know, it's sort of going to be changed, hopefully.
Now, you did mention our amazing Connell and Marianne and Normal People a bit earlier, and I was very pleased to see them getting a good starring role in your book, as in a more positive sense, in that you talk about sort of a new way of portraying sex, because really that sex scene, that first sex scene between Connell and Marianne in episode 2 of Normal People, was unlike anything that had ever been on the telly before, in that we saw a young woman who'd never had sex before having her first sexual experience with a young man who was concerned about her and cared about her, and at every stage was saying, is this okay? And it was absolutely mind-blowing, because the idea that we'd just never seen it, we see them laugh, him fumbling with her bra, you know, a very normal sex scene that despite everything we've talked about, these sex experiences do go on as well, with all this terrible stuff that we've been talking about. So was Normal People important, do you think, in terms of changing that narrative around consent and really showing what it can mean and how actually it can be very sexy?
Yeah, I think it was a real conversation starter for a lot of people. And I think in a way I felt kind of a touch of sadness, and I think a lot of people did, because it was like, wow, like, this is actually the first time, you know, or one of the very few occasions that you can see actually consent negotiation happening on screen, and it's portrayed in a way that's really sexy. It's hot, and it's, you know, it's respectful, and, you know, it shows, yeah, like you say, the awkwardness, the sort of fumbling embarrassment that happens in sex that you don't really often see on screen. And I think that, you know, that is really, that was just a wonderful thing to see. But again, I feel sad that was, you know, it took me until my, whatever it is, like early 30s to witness something like that on our screens. And I remember putting a tweet out around the time that I was researching the book, and Normal People had been on our screens and everything. And I thought, hang on, has anyone got any other examples, you know, of really positive consent negotiations happening on screen? And obviously that scene in Normal People came up, but a lot of people were really stumped and were like, the sad thing is, I can't think of any. And, I know that I think things are changing both, you know, I think both on screen and also behind the scenes, you know, with the introduction of intimacy coordinators. I think that's really, really important because, you know, it can't just always be, it is important for us as viewers to see these positive examples of consent and all of that. But you need to also make sure that you're practicing what you preach behind the scenes as well, with consent for the actors and making sure that they're not harmed by those scenes. And I think that was those were really interesting conversations to have as well.
And you spoke to Ita O'Brien, who's the intimacy coordinator, who we've had on the podcast too. She's a brilliant woman and she's such a pioneer. And now she's training other people to be intimacy coordinators as well, which is wonderful. So I suppose like you finish the book or you try to explore in the final sort of sections with how we go about changing our sexual culture. And it's a big ask. And I'm not sure whether, you know, it's probably too much of an ask for you to answer that. But at the same time, you do attempt to. And one part of it, I think very much what came clearly through for me is about our sex education, because our sex education in Ireland, woefully bad with a sort of a Catholic theocracy kind of on top of it as well. But yours wasn't much better either in the UK, despite not having perhaps that religious influence as much. We're not taught about these minor and major acts of sexual violence. We're not talked about sexual pleasure either. We're not talked about the fact that sex isn't just a penis and a vagina, that it's masturbation, that it's all sorts of other things that can go along with in the sexual spectrum. So is that somewhere that do you think it could make a big difference if our sex education started from an earlier age to encompass all of these things that we've spoken about?
I really think so. I think that education is key. It is alarming. I think, you know, I sit there and struggle sometimes because, you know, I look at what's happening in the UK at the moment. And, you know, there's just been news that Rishi Sunak wants to do a review of sex education because there's this fear that, you know, young people are being exposed to inappropriate material. And a lot of sex education charities reject this and say that this isn't the case. But, you know, sex education is under threat in the UK. And I find that really, really concerning because I'm like, you know, I would say that in many cases it's falling short still to this day. And the fact that, you know, we're now threatened with the idea of it, you know, regressing somehow is even more alarming. I'm like, oh God, like, are we really going to go back in time? But I do really think that education is key. I think, sex education needs to be inclusive. It needs to represent queer sex. It needs to talk about pleasure. It needs to talk about digital violations. It needs to talk about violence as well, sexual violence. People need to know about the reality of consent. You know, I think there's some research by the Sex Education Forum that shows that I think it's something like 50% of young people never learned about real life consent interactions. And I think that, you know, almost giving people a crib sheet of like, here's how to ask, you know, here's how to, you know, seek consent. Here are some non-awkward ways to go about that. And breaking down, you know, the mechanics of it, of, you know, if you want to introduce oral sex, you should ask for consent. Like all of these really, you know, what I would consider basic things, but that young people are just going out into the world not knowing. And I also think that porn literacy is a really important thing that I think young people, you know, I don't think the answer is limiting people's access to porn. I don't think it's realistic. And I just don't think that would be a good thing. I think teaching young people porn literacy and just sort of sex literacy in general would be a really important way to combat this sex misinformation crisis. Yeah. And the sort of the problems that we're seeing from porn.
I'm a big fan of Cindy Gallup and Make Love Not Porn. I don't know if you've come across that, but she's wonderful because this is about real life sex. And you know, it's about normal people having sex, literally going back to normal people. And that is kind of like countering all the message. And there is ethical porn out there also. And another concept you introduce in the book is ethical sex, that this is an idea that should be taught to young people. What is ethical sex? Sex where each person, whether it's a one night stand or whether it's a long term relationship, has a concern about the other human being that they're interacting with. And they don't see it as something that they just can objectify the person or not treat them like a human being. I mean, it sounds very basic and normal, but it's clearly not happening in a lot of our sexual culture.
Exactly. And I, you know, it felt ridiculous to me. I was like, do I really have to spell out, like, you know, be a good person? Like, it felt very strange and unnatural to have to say that. But, you know, the reality is, I think people almost feel like, you know, your morality or your ethics or whatever, they stop at the door when you're about to enter the bedroom, and, you know, that they feel almost like, I don't know, that they can't harm someone, or, you know, and I think that, yeah, just carrying the same values that you have in real life in your day-to-day interactions, you know, like, you wouldn't, if you were helping a stranger in the street, if you were having an interaction with someone in Sainsbury's or whatever, like, you wouldn't treat them with disrespect, you wouldn't want any harm to come to them. So how should sex be any different, you know? And it's just carrying through those basic sort of like ethical tenets that should be common, but sadly are not.
One part I really enjoyed near the end of the book as well is about how we need male allies, because it's something that we talk a lot about on this podcast, and how, you know, a lot of this conversation can be alienating for men, or can make men feel like they're really, which we, okay, to a certain degree they are the problem, but to another degree, you know, they are as much a victim of kind of the patriarchy and the way they've been socialized too. And that's really important to say. But I loved your talk with Liz Plank, the journalist who wrote a book about to encourage sort of more positive masculinity and not keep talking about this toxic masculinity, and how she helps young men kind of reflect on their own behavior rather than sort of tell them everything they're doing wrong. And she talks about how self-awareness and how helping young men to kind of look at what they're doing and why they're doing it, that really is a part of improving things as well. So that's a really good thing. But in a world, just finally, in a world where we have Andrew Tate thankfully locked up, we have all these, you know, this incel culture that Laura Bates has spoken about so well on this podcast and in her books, you know, are you still hopeful that the sexual culture can change, that all this talk and indeed your book and other commentators can make a difference? I mean, I'd like to end it on some kind of positive note.
Yeah, I think we have to be optimistic. I do have hope. I believe that, you know, I also don't think sex education stops when we're at school, right? And I do believe that, you know, I think our duty as, if you are a sexually active adult, then you should keep a curious and open mind, and you should have a desire to constantly want to learn new things and to, you know, just broaden your mind. And I just think that to be sex positive requires, you know, that a constant education, a constant learning curve. And I think that that's a really important thing in, you know, improving our sexual culture and coming at it from a place of curiosity and a willingness to perhaps also look back on past mistakes and think, you know, have I harmed someone? Has my behavior, you know, caused someone trauma? And how can I avoid doing that, you know, going forward? And I think that level of introspection is really, really important. And, you know, yeah, I believe in allyship. And I think that that's also really important when we're just tackling everyday instances of misogyny, racism, and, you know, everything else, every other form of discrimination. I think that, you know, we really need people to not be satisfied, to remain in the status quo, and to want to challenge the reality that is not good enough at present, you know?
Yeah. Because I must congratulate you for the book, for leaving no stone unturned, because there's stuff in there about fat phobia during sex. There's stuff about ableism. There's a lot about the trans community as well. So you really do look at every kind of discrimination and that can go on in terms of the whole sexual area. So it's a really important book. And as I said, congratulations. And hopefully it will contribute to a positive change in that whole area. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
That was Rachel Thompson there, and the book is called Rough: How Violence Found Its Way Into the Bedroom and What We Can Do About It. If you have any comments on what you've heard, we're on social at IT Women's Podcast or on email thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com. The podcast is produced by Suzanne Brennan, Aideen Finnegan and me, Roisin Ingle, with JJ Vernon on sound. And that's it from me. Mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.